Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. John Clements has the day off today, and we are talking about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. Good morning, George.
Were you going to say gents, the two of us?
I don't know if I was going to say gents or John, but either way.
Okay, well, I'll accept your George thing there. And good morning. How are you? Dinner.
I'm good.
You might need another cup of coffee.
I might need something. Yeah, I might need something. There's quite a bit of stuff going on these days. And one of the things that I was looking at that I thought was interesting was, and I racked my brain thinking about all these different things because they never come all in groups. It all comes in ones and twos, it seems like. But industry scourges, things that have really affected the gardening and landscaping industry in Southern California, at least over my lifetime. I've been doing this for 44 years now, but during that time,
and you're 45 now,
and I'm 45. Yeah. But during that time period, in the early part of my career, I don't remember that many things really affecting the nursery business the nursery and landscaping business that much. One of the ones that I do remember though, that has been a perpetual problem my entire lifetime in this business is fire blight. Typically only attacks plants in the Rosaceae family, but that's a big family. So Roses can be susceptible to it.
Apples are certainly susceptible.
Apples
and pears.
Pears. I think Raphalipus is actually susceptible to it too.
Loquats.
Right. But probably the thing that is most susceptible to it are pears, especially ornamental pears, the Pyrus kawakami.
I would say the ornamentals are worse than some of the edible pears.
Yeah. Right. Oh, it's terrible. And I could actually challenge people to go out and find an ornamental pear in San Diego County that does not show some fire blight on it. It is everywhere. It is rampant. And the problem with it is you really have to keep it under control or it spreads like wildfire.
It's difficult to control too.
It is very
difficult.
Because
it's going to spread by tools that you're using, but also just from insects. Bees pollinating will bring it from plant to plant.
It infects the plants through the flowers.
Right.
I believe copper spray with the proper timing will reduce the incidence of it. I don't think it will eliminate it.
You have to prune out the bad stuff.
Yes, you do.
And then you can spray. I have a two regular pear trees. I think it was my Florida home. Don't quote me on it, but one of them that says it is fire blight resistant on the tag is the only Rosaceae in our yard that got fire blight. The one that said fire blight resistant. And we have 16 different apple varieties plus, you know, some Asian pears, but that particular one said that it was fire blight resistant and it ended up having fire blight on one branch. And I diligently went out there and cut out all the bad wood. I just kept cutting back, and I cleaned my shears on every single cut.
That is the advisement is to,
And then I sprayed it with copper. And then about a week later, I sprayed it with copper again. And then I didn't have a problem on it. And that was 3 years ago. And ever since, anytime I prune that tree, I clean the shears between every single cut just out of fear.
Yeah. And if you're cutting back a pear tree or anything that you suspect of having fire blight, when you make that cut, you don't want to make it right at the end, right at the base of where the damage is. You need to go back another 4 or 5 inches.
You
got to get
back
ahead of it.
Right.
And as far as sterilizing shears is concerned, what was always recommended was a 10% Clorox solution or 10% bleach and water, and just have a bucket of it by your side and dip them in, shake them around every time you make a cut. And you know, when you think about it and you see some of these big trees that are infested with it,
Yeah, you're
that's an incredible job.
And it won't, I don't think you'll be cured on those large trees. I think it's
I think it's too far gone.
Right, exactly.
You can't get ahead of it. You just physically, I don't know that you could go out and make all those cuts. Where I notice it a lot, well, I haven't looked at it recently, but where I used to see it all the time was in front of the old entrance to the Natural History Museum in the plaza. There's that whole plaza is planted with Pyrus kawakami, and almost every one of them has fireblight in it.
The ornamental pear. Right.
Yeah. The one that's blooming right now.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. They bloom.
Spring is here.
It's a beautiful tree, but man, you really gotta weigh the downside of it. And the only downside that I can think of it is fireblight. If you're okay with going out and doing the maintenance that needs to be done to it to keep it under control, then that's fine.
And I don't know, I wish John were here today for this because he's seen it on larger scales, but I just think that you could not, as a homeowner, get up in the tree, because they get big. I just don't think as a homeowner you are going to have the wherewithal to go out there and prune it back adequately to get rid of all of the bad wood in there and then spray it in a manner that's going to provide adequate coverage to help prevent the spread of the fire blight. So I don't think that's doable. I was surprised because of our pear tree that had it. It sits beside a pear tree and about 14, 15 feet from a loquat.
Mm-hmm.
So if anything else was going to get it, and two other apples. So I was very fortunate that it stayed in that one tree.
Yeah. I think I've seen it on roses less than half a dozen times. The telltale sign of fire blight is that it looks like the tips of the, it's usually starts at the tips of the branches and starts right where the flower was.
And it works its way back.
Yeah. But right. it literally looks like that branch was burned.
Right. Someone held a torch or a lighter underneath it.
Exactly. So, and like I said, I've seen it a few times in roses, and I've seen it a few times in Indian hawthorn, Raphalepis, which is amazing because that is a tough plant. I mean, it's once you get it in and get it established, it's really hard to kill it.
I like them, especially the Majestic Beauty. When they are in beautiful. Full bloom, they're spectacular.
It
they
is
have
spectacular.
A nice, I think, a nice fragrant, and they are a bee factory. They love it.
Yeah. If you want spring color, and you want pink, or
but it's not majestic.
It's not the same.
Right.
Any of the Raphalepis, any of the pink Raphalepis will do just amazing, and they bloom like crazy. And like you said, they are a bee factory.
The only thing I don't like about them, and it's a personal preference, is they're kind of pedestrian. They are everywhere.
They're everywhere.
You know, they're at your grandmother's house from 1952, and they're at the shopping center and your dentist office. They are just in all kinds of commercial landscaping because they're bulletproof.
Yeah.
They do really well once you get them established, but they're so ubiquitous that it's like, do I want this in my yard?
It's what we used to refer to as a top 40 plant.
Sure.
And most of the, when you would go to a garden center at like Walmart and some of the, I don't want to say lower end garden centers, but some of the just more pedestrian garden centers that we used to refer to plants like that as top 40s, because that's what they would carry.
Right.
We carry them out of necessity, but we carry a ton of them, a lot more than other places do, because there's a lot of varieties out there.
There is.
But there's a lot of other stuff that we carry on top. We carry the top 40 stuff because that's what a lot of people are looking for, but we also carry a lot of other things as well.
And that's why John Clements always says, shop at your local garden centers, because you'll find a much larger variety than in those other stores.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You'll find all kinds of stuff. Another one that I remember early on in my career was oleander gall. And that was, I don't know if it was a bacterial disease or a viral disease that affected oleanders, and it manifested itself. It would get in through the flowers, and a gall would form on the seed pods after the flowers had been pollinated. And once it got started in Southern California, it went rampant, and it wiped out the oleander industry the oleander growing industry in Southern California for many years. Monrovia used to grow, I don't I can't even remember how many different oleanders they grew, but they had a whole series of dwarf oleanders and the standard size oleanders. Oleander was a top 40 plant.
It's a tough plant, very drought tolerant,
extremely drought tolerant, and pretty much bulletproof until oleander gall came along. And there were a lot of wholesale growers that just quit growing it because you couldn't control it. And it was one of those diseases that, unlike the fire blight, once it got established in the plant, it was done. You could keep cutting the plant back, and you could prolong its ultimate death, but you weren't going to stop it. And we had mentioned as before we went on the show when we were talking about what we were going to talk about, all the freeways in Southern California were lined with oleander.
When I arrived in California in January of 1979, mm-hmm. I went up to my aunt's house that day up in Oceanside and drove up the 5 and the entire median,
yep.
from pretty much when we got on off the 8 or whatever, all the way up was oleander.
Yeah.
As far as the eye could see.
I think that probably stretched all the way to the border. It was everywhere.
And you suspect that was the gall, because there's another disease, right? The oleander scorch.
The oleander scorch, but that came on. It was probably a combination of the two. I think the scorch probably was more prevalent in wiping out oleander. Uh-huh. But that was another when we moved into this store here in Poway, the entire business park was covered with oleander. You drive around through the business park now, I don't think there's any of them left.
No,
but it was everywhere.
Right.
And the oleander scorch, which is another one that was on our list that we were going to talk about, is caused by a bacterial infection. Xylella is the is the prime mover on that one.
And that's spread by glassy wing sharpshooter.
And that's a terrible little insect. It's wreaked a lot of havoc in Southern California.
You know, I think we touched on it a show or two ago about how difficult it is to take a picture of it.
Yeah, because they bounce.
If you approach it, it flips exactly 180 degrees behind the branch that you were looking at or a leaf. It is incredibly quick.
Almost instantaneously.
It's magic.
Yeah, it really is incredible. But that insect is also the one that vectored Pierce's disease.
Right.
And Pierce's disease
is on
pretty much wiped out the grape crop or the wineries in Temecula. So we've got more to talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman, and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. Before the break, we were talking about Xylella and all the havoc that it has wreaked in the plant industry in Southern California, from oleander scorch to wiping out vineyards in Temecula. That seems to have gotten under control. When it was really taking hold here in Southern California, I had a friend of mine owned a nursery in Santa Elena up in Napa Valley, and Napa went berserk when it really started rolling down here, for obvious reasons.
Well, clearly, right.
And he said that at his nursery, when they would get shipments in, like he was a customer of Monrovia Nursery. And at that time, a lot of their growing area was in Azusa.
Okay.
And they would bring in truckloads of stuff up to Northern California. He said they had ag inspectors on site that looked at every plant that came off of the truck. And he said they were looking for the egg sacs, looking for
glassy-winged sharpshooter
egg sacs.
Right.
And they really clamped down on it up there. I don't know if that's still the case, but they were in panic mode up there. And I can't say as I blame them. That was probably Pierce's disease for grapes was probably the HLB of its time.
That's a good analogy, disease. Right?
Yeah. But it also affects other plants. Liquid ambers.
Liquid amber dieback.
Liquid amber dieback.
And I think Capri and I have removed I could do math real quick in my head. I think we've removed 6 liquid ambers off the property.
We took a couple out
that
here.
We're not doing well.
Yeah, we took a couple out here that we're not doing well because of that. The other one that it has been attributed to also is olive leaf scorch.
Right.
And now, when we say Xylella, there's a lot of different strains.
Right.
And each, and like the Xylella strain for Pierce's disease is different from the Xylella strain for oleander scorch and liquid.
And sweet gum dieback, as I understand it as well. Yeah, there are different strains.
They are different strains.
Almond leaf scorch as well, mulberry leaf scorch, oleander, olive, as you mentioned, and the sweet gum dieback are some of the more common.
Yeah. And then I had come across an article saying that olive leaf scorch may not necessarily be Xylella. And when we had Pedro Barry here, the arborist who was talking to us about it, he said that there's a lot of research going on right now also that shows that Xylella may not be the main cause of olive leaf scorch. And in this article that I found, it says over the last 25 years or so, too, it has shown sometimes severe dieback decline and death, which has also been attributed to Xylella. However, again, it might not be Xylella, but rather a fungal disease complex acting in concert with poor cultivation and stressed trees that is responsible for the decline and death. And it said more work is needed on liquid amber styraciflua to confirm the cause of its decline. And then this was interesting. Despite this research-based evidence, perhaps because it was not well promoted or publicized or people just ignored it, many landscape managers, designers, and architects thought that the Xylella was spelling the end of the olive industry in California, which would result in a shortage or lack of highly desirable landscape olive trees. However, while olive acreage might be declining in California, it is not because of Xylella, which was shown not to be a significant pathogen of olive or even the fungal complex, which can attack stressed olive trees. Rather, the decline of olive acreage is because olive growers are switching to more profitable crops like pistachios.
That's interesting.
So it's kind of a market-driven thing.
Maybe so, but Pedro did mention that watering is a big factor in what people are, or when people, especially homeowners, are losing their olive trees.
And I think I had mentioned my neighbor a couple doors down from me has a big olive tree in their front yard, in their lawn, and it shows some early signs of olive leaf scorch, and I'm guessing it's because it's planted in a lawn.
Getting too much water. Right. So the way that the UCIPM suggests that you help prevent the spread of this is to get rid of diseased plants immediately. And then secondly is to reduce the insect vector. So you need to do things to keep the glasswing sharpshooter at bay.
And
interestingly, you know what one of the overwintering evergreen hosts are for sharpshooters?
No.
Citrus.
Really?
Yep.
I don't think I've ever seen one on a citrus tree.
Yeah, that's when I tried to take pictures of them and they dart around. So UCIPM says that they overwinter in trees like citrus and oleander. And it's important to help control those so that they can't bite an infected tree and then bring it to another one.
The only plant in my yard that I ever saw them on was the Clayera, which we had talked about with John in a previous show. It's right outside my back door. And every once in a while you would spot them when there was raining down their excrement over the patio. So in the evening sun, you could just see it showering down. And then probably the biggest one, and one of the ones that's had the most impact nationwide, has been HLB, or the citrus greening disease. And that's been going on now for 15 years?
Probably a little
years?
Bit more, yeah. Ooh, yeah, probably. Especially in Florida,
In Florida,
right?
Much, much longer than out here in California. But I remember when they first found it here in San Diego County. Well, they didn't find HLB. They found the psyllid.
The psyllid, right.
And it was down in Sweetwater, I think, is where they found the first ones. And then they realized that, okay, well, if it's here, it's everywhere.
Right.
And they've been working very hard to control it. The state has clamped down, I would say probably about a third of the state is under HLB quarantine to some extent or another. There's different variations of the quarantines depending on how severe the threat is.
And also whether you're a commercial grower and, you know, if you're a shipper of citrus, you're in a different type of quarantine than a seller of a citrus tree.
Yeah.
And a homeowner as well.
Well, and the quarantine procedures and the things they have in place to try to keep it under control, even picked fruit all has to be treated specially to try to make sure that it's not getting around. And I believe, and I don't, you may have more current information on this, George, but I believe not too long ago, HLB had not been found in a commercial grove yet, but I think they did find it in a grove. I don't remember where.
I think you may be correct, and we can look that up and try to.
You'd have to do some research on that. But it was all in homeowners.
And it's in homeowners because, as you and I were chatting earlier, a lot of folks, and we've talked about this on the air now for 5 years, maybe, a lot of folks, when they buy a house that has citrus and it's working well for them and it starts to decline a little bit or it's not looking good, they'll come in and say, my tree doesn't look good. You know, what can I do? And you ask, well, when was the last time you fed it? How do you water? When was the last time you sprayed it? Mm-hmm. And so I don't do anything to it. It's always done well. And I think that contributes to the spread, because if you're not doing anything, then you are having a host plant that's carrying, you know, a big load of vectors,
yeah,
the psyllid that is moving from your trees. And your trees may not be infected, but you have these insects that now have, you know, the larger population of insects that may be flying to a tree that is infected and then moving on to infect other trees. So it's really important that if you're not going to have citrus, if you don't want to deal with it, that you get rid of it, number one. And if you are going to have it, that you do spray periodically.
Yeah.
To help keep those insects at bay and reduce that vector.
Yeah. And if you the incidence of it right now is still pretty low. But that's why they're being so vigilant on it, because they want to keep it low and want to keep it under control.
This nursery where we're broadcasting from in Poway is, what, a half mile from the northern border of the current quarantine?
Something like that.
So,
yeah, we're close.
Right. So, and my yard is in, our Poway home is in the quarantine zone.
Yeah. And you suspected that you had a tree that was
I suspected infected. Co-workers looked at it. I had two arborist friends look at it, and every one of them, you know, sucked air through their teeth when they looked at it and went, wow, yeah, that looks like HLB. And then I had the county come out, or the ag department, and the young man that came looked at it and said, this looks like HLB, but, you know, we won't be sure until we get the lab results. And thankfully, you know, it was not a positive HLB find, but it had every appearance of being HLB.
Were you able to salvage the tree?
Oh, yeah, it's doing really well. Oh, but at the time, it just looked, I mean, every leaf was different. It wasn't a magnesium deficiency. It wasn't it didn't appear to be magnesium or zinc, which give you similar symptoms. Anyway, bottom line is, you know, if to help keep this HLB at bay, we need to reduce that vector.
And be vigilant on it.
Right.
And as you mentioned, if you suspect that you have it, what I would do is... Don't bring samples of the plant into any nursery or garden center, but take as many pictures and as close up pictures of the affected areas as you possibly can. Bring those in and we will take a look at them. Any good garden center would be happy to take a look at them. And if it's suspected that, if the consensus is that it may be an HLB infection, call the ag department, because they want to know. They need to know.
Absolutely.
And they will send somebody out to take a look, to examine the tree, take samples and run it through the lab, just like they did yours. And hopefully it won't be that. It was up in Los Angeles or Orange County. I want to say it was in Yorba Linda. They found it. They found HLB in a stand of citrus that was an abandoned lemon orchard. It was on property. The orchard had been planted years ago, and then they stopped production and just left it. And that abandoned orchard, because nobody was taking care of it, it was a perfect spot for psyllid to take hold. And unfortunately, there were some that had been infected, and they got a hold of it. But the big growers, they're terrified of this, and so they're
monitoring. They probably have pheromone traps out. They're spraying on a regular basis to control
it. To keep everything under control.
You know, the first time that psyllid was found in the United States was in 1998 in Florida. And then here for us in California, it was 2008.
Okay. So that's about, yeah, yeah. about Yeah, that's about, yeah. That's what, 17 years ago?
Been
yeah.
a while.
Yeah, so that sounds about right. And, you know, we had mentioned it before, but that's the other thing to think about too, when you're purchasing citrus in anywhere in the quarantine zone in California, it's not organic. So
right.
if you want organic citrus, you can grow organic citrus, but it's not going to start out organic. It's going to be on you to have the proper cultural practices
right.
to make it organic.
Exactly.
But every citrus that is legally sold in
that's a good caveat in
San Diego County, Orange, and I think LA and most of Riverside has to be treated before it can be shipped to a nursery
right for sale.
So yeah, you're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We have classes today, February 22nd, in our Poway store. It's going to be Brigitte from San Diego Seed Company, who was on the show last week.
Yeah. Yep.
You can see her in person, and she's going to be doing a class on seed starting, always a popular class.
So. Yeah, I would argue the most popular class that we do. She has held the record. I schedule the classes here, so I get a pretty good sense of what we have. She has the record. I think it was 119 people.
That's a lot
out there when she brings a class. So if you want to see her and you want a seat, get here early.
Get here early. Otherwise, it'll be standing room
right.
only. And then in San Diego at 9 o'clock, it's going to be terrarium construction and care with Aaron. Brigitte's class starts at 9:30, but I would get here a little early just to be on the safe side if you want to sit. If you have a question or a suggestion or somebody you would like to see us talk to on the show, email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. And remember, Anderson is spelled S-E-N. Spell it S-O-N, it'll go to the other walteranderson.com, who sometimes forwards it to us. But it'll go directly to us if you spell it S-E-N. Before the break, we were talking about HLB and the problems that it has wreaked with the citrus industry here in Southern California, California and Florida.
What I was going to say though, Ken, is when you mentioned, you know, call the ag department, they'll want to know. That's the reason they want to know, because they're trying to protect the very, very valuable citrus industry in California.
Oh yeah.
And so they're trying to protect that. It's a multi-billion dollar industry.
Yes, it is. There was a Brazilian study. I thought this was very interesting, that has shown that planting citrus plots parallel to property boundaries reduced HLB spreading psyllids 12 to 23% compared to plots planted perpendicular to the property. But my question is, which boundary are you planting it parallel to? Because if you have a square,
sure,
you're going to end up with a perpendicular spot
There's no photograph or
no.
map. Okay, that's interesting.
But it says here, researchers observed that higher plant density results in a lower proportional incident of HLB, percentage of infected plants. However, the absolute number of diseased plants remains similar between the different densities. This suggests that increasing density may be an interesting strategy to reduce production losses as more healthy plants remain available to compensate for those lost to infected ones. That's kind of interesting.
It's almost counterintuitive.
It does seem that way. Right. It does seem that way. So we'll keep an eye on what's going on down in Brazil, which is where that came from. And I didn't realize this, but the citrus industry in Brazil is huge. It's huge.
Yep.
It's growing all the time. Unlike the United States, where I came across this statistic, in the last 20 years, Florida's total citrus production has decreased by more than 90%, from around 300 million boxes in 2003-2004, which was a few years after the introduction of HLB in Florida, to just 20 million boxes in 2023 and 2024. That's a mind-boggling drop in production. And I remember as a kid, Florida was citrus. That was it.
I went to boot camp there in Orlando, and outside the barracks over the fence wall were just groves and groves, you know, just acres and acres of citrus.
Yeah, that's all the Orlando Convention Center now.
I know, that's what I've heard. Yeah.
And then some of the contributing factors were citrus greening, HLB, that we had talked about, drastically lowered citrus production, freezes and canker. Florida experienced frequent freezes in the late 1800s and to the late 1900s, forcing many groves out of business. Not longer after experiencing citrus freezes, Florida's citrus industry was struck by citrus canker. While it was first seen in Florida in the early 1900s, an outbreak in 1995 caused a tremendous decline in citrus trees in Florida. In 2002, a mandate for destruction of any trees within a 1,900-foot radius of any diseased tree was passed. A total of 16 million trees were cut down or burned as a result. The program was ultimately shut down in 2006 when it was deemed ineffective. And that's a lot of... That's a lot of acreage to burn down to decide, that didn't work.
Yep.
So,
you know, I'm going to go back. Prior to the break, you had said that you can't buy an organic citrus tree, and then you caveated it with legal, mm-hmm. right? Legally purchased. The first incident of HLB in California is believed, I mean, it's documented, that it came from an infected graft that someone brought in illegally, brought into the state illegal grafting wood mm-hmm. that was infected with HLB.
Yeah, I remember.
And it spread. So it's really important that if you're going to get bud wood, you get it from a reliable source like UC Riverside, which has a really good Scion exchange program or purchase program. Mm-hmm. So illegal grafting and infected budwood and moving citrus is part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, just going back to the, because I see it on Facebook Gardener and other exchange sites where people say, oh, I've got a citrus. I'm not, it's been in a pot for 6 years, I'll trade it for something. And the state does not want you trading citrus across.
No, they would prefer even fruit. They prefer that you don't do that, and that's why we request that you don't bring the actual
right
portions of the plant in. Yeah, we found out about that several years ago, kind of the hard way. We were doing some work with the fair and Rich Haas over at the infield farm. Needed some citrus, so we procured a fairly large number of 15-gallon citrus trees and had them drop shipped over to the fair. Well, when our grower drop shipped them, because
for clarity, what is drop ship? Because you're in an industry here.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Drop shipping is when we contact our grower, place an order for a lot of plant material. And then the grower's truck takes it directly to our customer. So it goes directly from the grower's yard to the customer. It doesn't happen very often.
Right.
Most everything
comes through
one of our locations and then goes out to the customer. But on large orders like that, it's easier for us just to
right.
to place the order and have it sent directly to our customer. And there's some companies that won't do it at all, but our grower was amenable to it. So they took the plants over to the fairgrounds, dropped them at the infield farm, ran the course of the fair, and then we found out at the end of the fair that the plants had not been tagged with treatment tags. They had been treated, but they hadn't been tagged with treatment tags because they were not going to be sold. They were going to the fair. Well, ultimately, the idea was that we were going to sell them.
Oh, they were going to come back here.
They were going to come back here. But unfortunately, because they were not tagged, we couldn't remove them from the fairgrounds. So they spent the rest of their lives at the fairgrounds. So it was you had to do it. I mean, that's just the way it is. But it was an interesting lesson to say.
And that is also why if you purchase citrus from our store, it's a final sale.
Yeah.
It's not that there's anything wrong with it and we don't want it back, but once it leaves the site, we can't take it back.
We can't take it right. back. Yeah. So, and then anytime, and even though we request that people don't bring citrus in, people still do. And we don't, tell them to get out or anything
well,
like
I
that.
I do, but that's just the way I approach people. No.
Are a people person.
But citrus, the citrus itself, if it's washed thoroughly and there are no twigs, leaves on it, then it's fine.
Yeah.
Because it's not transmitted through the rind of a orange or a tangerine, but it's the branches and twigs and leaves that make it problematic.
Yeah, that's the worst part about it. So anyway, that's a kind of a brief rundown of some of the horrendous things that we've had to deal with. Well, for us, it's horrendous, but
The rest of the country has other things. There are beetles and borers that are just decimating things
all over the place. Yep. Yeah. So I guess all in all, we're pretty lucky.
We are very fortunate.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah. Some of the other, one of the other things that we had been talking about before the show was rabbits and rabbit damage in yards, which can be pretty severe at times, especially vegetable gardens. And for a long time, they were attacking our citrus trees.
Oh,
to the point where we actually had to raise the citrus up off the.
And every night the yard crew would put a snow fence around to keep the bunnies out.
And they would jump up into the pots and just defoliate the citrus. And I had read one time someone said that rabbits will not jump up. Rabbits can't jump over 3 feet. Well,
we disproved that
when we found rabbits on our vegetable tables in the bedding section.
I brought my trail camera in and set it up.
Yeah. So
we're like, what's eating, are there rats or mice? What's eating all the vegetables?
And yeah. So
trail camera. Yeah.
But, Melanie and I were talking to you just before we came on the air about rabbits, and we don't have a bad rabbit problem at our house anymore, but it's been years since we've had, we used to have rabbits in the back. Like they would come out around sunset. Every night we'd have 3 or 4 rabbits feeding in the backyard. I haven't seen a rabbit in my yard in over a year, either front or back.
We still have them, but not quite in the quantity that we've had in the past.
I do believe that there was a virus that was going around that was wiping out the native rabbit populations for a while. So, things are cyclical. Ebbs and flows. So I would expect within the next few years, I'm probably going to have rabbits all over my backyard again.
That's probably why I haven't seen the quantity of coyotes. We used to have coyotes every night at sunset at twilight. They'd start meandering in the morning and at night across the property.
Oh, you can take mine.
Well,
we still have them.
I know you do. But we were on a hike 2 days ago, I think, when I was telling Melanie, it was the first time we've seen a coyote out, just before sunset in some time where we live. I know mm-hmm. they're there because there's evidence of it, but we have not seen them in the same way that we used to.
Yeah. We had evidence of them in our yard, about a week ago. For whatever reason, my outdoor cameras are not sensitive enough to catch coyotes for the most part. Yeah. They'll catch all kinds of nothing.
Maybe those are very fast coyotes.
Yeah. I don't know, but something the size of a coyote tends to not trip the camera, but, they leave their calling card in our yard. So we have to go and clean that up, which is not the funnest thing in the world.
But there are some plants you can plant that bunnies don't particularly like, and we can talk about those after the break.
Maybe. Yeah, we're going to take a quick break, and we will talk about plants that rabbits do not like to eat, and we'll have a lot more here on Garden Talk on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We were talking about rabbits, rabbit damage in your yard or landscaping, and they kind of come and go. Hasn't been a problem for us lately, but I'm certain that it's going to come back, and they will be a problem again at some point in time. But you have a list of plants that people come in and ask, what can I plant that rabbits are not going to eat? Up until a few years ago, when we had that serious problem with the citrus, I never expected that rabbits would eat citrus. It just was not on my radar at all.
What I typically tell folks is, there are some plants that they avoid. And we actually have a handout that you can get at the nursery that says, what bunnies eat or will damage. And then it says what bunnies will generally avoid. And mm-hmm. it's underlined generally because they're opportunists. If there's no other food around, they may eat plants that typically they would not. Kind of like, you know, if you didn't like sardines, but it was the only thing available to you.
You're going
to
eat
it. You might eat them,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So we have a number of plants that they typically will eat, and people come in all the time. You know, lawns obviously get eaten all the time. And, mm-hmm. and you had mentioned your garden. What I have learned is the very best way to keep them from eating your plants is some kind of exclusion. You know, so if it's yeah. a vegetable garden, just a fence high enough that they can't jump over is yeah. adequate to keep them out.
Which has to be over 3 feet.
Which has to be over 3 feet, as we learned here. Yeah. But generally, they avoid a lot of things. They don't like Alyssum or Alyssum. They don't like begonias, cactus, coleus, foxglove.
You know, it's interesting. Those are all, well, except, well, foxgloves are poisonous.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
the other ones are all kind of fleshy, more succulent.
And I'm surprised because like Alyssum is yeah. in the Brassiaceae family.
That's true.
So I'm surprised yeah. that they don't eat that. But yeah. In patients, lavenders, lantana, myoporum, osteospermum or African daisies, mm-hmm. Pentas, rosemary, snapdragons. The rust eats the snapdragons.
Yeah, you talk about rosemary. The only things that I have ever seen eat rosemary are either Melanie and I or spittle bugs.
I get spider mites occasionally, but spittle bugs for sure.
Spittle bugs, yep. yeah. Yep. And for those of you that don't know what a spittle bug is, it's a small insect that it's the way that it protects itself is that it secretes this
foam.
Goo, this foam right. that encapsulates it on the plant. So if you go out to a plant, especially like you said, rosemary is very common, and you see these big globs of foam in the plant, you have spittle bug. The good news is it's really easy to take care of it. I mean, just a strong stream of water, just wash it off the plant, and it's done.
It's done. Yeah, it's not protected any longer.
It's not protected right. any longer. It won't come back. So it doesn't leave a harmful residue or anything. So that if you have spittle bug, that's the way to control it. Yeah. Another funny story about spittle bug. I can't remember if I mentioned it or not, but we had when I was growing up in Bay Park, we had a big strawberry guava tree in our backyard, which I'm not a huge fan of strawberry guavas. They just don't do anything for me, but
it's a pretty plant though. It's
not a bad
dark
looking plant.
Leaf yeah. evergreen plant. Yeah.
But I remember that got an infestation of spittle bug, and it was kind of out in the backyard by the area where my neighbor and I used to play all the time. And I remember we'd be playing under the tree, and it would rain Ugh. Down on us that whatever it was that they would secrete. So, but
the only yeah. two plants that I have ever really noticed them on at the aforementioned rosemary. There, it's always in rosemary yeah. and some of my salvias.
Okay. Yeah. yeah.
But other than that, I really,
it's not, it's not super common.
No,
it's not super common. It's not a terribly destructive plant.
Easily managed.
So what else do you have on your list there, George?
Ice plants, St. Augustine, they don't eat St. Augustine grass, but they will eat your fescue.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, they will eat fescue. They will also, mow on Bermuda grass too.
Yeah, and they like sweet peas. They love your vegetable garden, as we mentioned.
Sweet peas. Yep. That's interesting because yep. I thought sweet peas were toxic.
Probably to you.
Well, maybe to
you know, it's like the Duranta, the sweet, what's it? Memories, the Duranta sky flower.
Right? Yeah, Brazilian sky flower.
So, yeah, that has those little yellow berries mm-hmm. that form on it, the fruit, which is highly toxic to
yes,
people,
it is.
To people, but birds can eat
can eat it. That's true.
Bunnies love marigolds, which we have a lot of customers come in regularly because they planted marigolds and then they're gone the next day. And they ask, mm-hmm. what can I plant that looks like a marigold? Because yeah. the bunnies just ate all mine. They like dianthus.
Okay.
Daimondia.
Daimondia. That's an interesting one because it grows so low to the ground. I would think it would be difficult for them to eat.
Well, you know, you say that, but then you mentioned that they like Bermuda grass.
Yeah, but Bermuda still going to grow an inch and a half, 2 inches. Yeah.
They like mums, Santa Barbara daisy.
Okay.
And I have a bunch of that. We have that underneath a couple fruit trees. And I haven't noticed any rabbit population. Anyway, those are some things that they like. Obviously, as I mentioned at the beginning, they avoid certain things, but in the absence of food, you know, if they were eating your lawn and that was the only green thing in your yard,
Yeah.
And they weren't bothering any of your other plants. Yeah. And you take out the lawn, they may make their way to the other plants.
Yeah. Yeah. That, yeah, it's amazing what, it's amazing what things hunger will drive.
Exactly. I might eat sardines if I needed to. My dad loves sardines, so it's always on my mind. What about repellents? Have you had any success for? I've tried them just as an experiment, and I've never had any success with repellents for rabbits.
I personally have not, but I have talked to customers, and I think the one that we have sold that has been the most effective is liquid vents.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say liquid the rabbit vents. Scram.
Yeah. But here's the problem with a repellent. If you have a yard that butts up to a green space or something, or if you have any kind of a yard where you have a rabbit problem, but you have shrubbery in the yard where the rabbits can hide, one of the things that you can do with liquid fence is you can set up a barrier to keep the rabbits out of your yard. But if you spray that barrier around your yard and you have rabbits in your yard hiding when you spray, you just locked them into your yard. They will not cross. The same barrier that will keep them from crossing into your yard will keep them from crossing out of your yard. The other problem with liquid fence is that it smells horrendous. It is one
which
of
is
the
maybe
most,
one of the reasons they don't want to cross it.
I believe that has something to do with it. It is one of the most horrific smelling things I have. I mean, I've smelled a lot of garden chemicals over the years, just either using them or selling them. But man, liquid fence is the worst. It is the worst. But you spray it and put it down. But once it dries, you can't smell it. But the rabbits still can.
Okay.
So it's it's the residual. But as is the case with pretty much all repellents, it's negative reinforcement. So you have to keep up with the suggested program. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Right.
If you just do it once and forget it, you're not going to have any success.
I think exclusion becomes the better way because that becomes an expensive endeavor to be spraying, especially if you have a large property. And as you mentioned, if you're up to a green belt where, you know, you may have some property and you're always going to have rabbits or other rodents coming on.
Mm-hmm.
It gets to be.
Well, that was huge. one of the precautions that we took here at the nursery in Poway to try to limit the amount of rabbits that we have within the store grounds. We have chain link and wrought iron fence all the way around the 5 acres here. We wrapped that fence with half inch hardware cloth,
yep,
all the way around to try to reduce the entryway,
right.
Because on the back, especially on the side and the back of the nursery, it all butts up to green space, and a lot of the banking area back there is covered with acacia redolands,
which is a great habitat
for them. So they're back there and hanging out. So we wrapped the fence with a half inch hardware cloth. And I think it would, but by doing so, I know we trapped some rabbits within the store, but it prevented, I do believe it slowed down the population from moving into the store. You can't stop them all, but it can slow them. You reduce the points of entry, and it's going to help.
It does. Absolutely.
But like you said, if you're going to use a repellent, then that, in an area that's highly susceptible to rabbit damage or around rabbit populations, it's going to be a lot of work, and it's going to be
expensive.
It's going to be expensive. Yeah. So
and that's where, if you can't do the exclusion, maybe start looking at plants that rabbits don't like.
Yes.
As another way to cut your costs.
Cut your costs. I came across an article. It was 11 facts you didn't know about Napa Valley, which is a very interesting place in California, a beautiful part of the state. If you ever have a chance to go up there, I highly recommend it, whether you drink wine or not. Napa Valley produces only 4% of California's wine and a mere 0.4% of the world's wine, yet it stands as one of the most renowned wine regions globally. The 4% shocked me. I mean, that whenever you think about California, when you think about California wine, you think about Napa and Sonoma. You don't think about Temecula, even though there's a huge wine industry down there.
Or Paso Robles.
Or Paso Robles is another big one. Napa Valley's wine industry supports over 50,000 jobs within the county and approximately 200,000 nationwide, contributing more than $34 billion to the U.S. economy. That's a pretty big number. Approximately 95% of Napa Valley wineries are family-owned. That's pretty impressive. The valley is about 30 miles long and 5 miles wide at its broadest point, with the Napa River running north and south through its center. Valley's vineyards span elevations from sea level up to 2,600 feet, offering diverse microclimates that contribute to the unique characteristics of its wines. That I did know. Napa Valley is home to over 300 stone arch bridges, more than any other county in the United States. I may have to go up I've been up there, I've never seen one of them. So I'll have to go up and look for that. Devastating Phytoszerella epidemic from 1989 to 1992 led to the loss of nearly 50,000 acres of Napa grapevines. In 1976, during the Judgment of Paris, Napa Valley's 1973 Chateau Montalena, Chardonnay, and Stag's Leap wine cellars, Cabernet Sauvignon, surpassed esteemed French wines in blind tasting. Region's Mediterranean climate is rare, as only 2% of the Earth's surface shares this climate type, providing ideal conditions for grape cultivation. We have that down here. Region's first commercial winery, Charles Krug Winery, was established in 1861 and continues to operate today. And the region's unique terroir includes over 100 different soil variations, more than any other wine region in the world. So there you have
it. That's significant.
Yeah, it is. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. We're going to be back next week with another hour of Garden Talk. If you'd like to drop us an email, email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com.
And next week, we're going to have Mike Letzring from the San Diego Zoo.
Yes.
He's one of their horticulturalists.
Yes. So he's going to be talking to us about all kinds of stuff going on at the zoo. So tune in. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.